I should mention here that there's some work going on in your house as we're recording this. So, for any, you've already heard some of the sauce. Please go on.
Let's see. The end of the year came and they thought they would have been free, but they weren't. And they didn't know what was going on in the world. They were totally isolated. The only thing they knew was that every night thousands of bombers would come over. My mother got a little job in the kitchen from 3 a.m. I told you this is a long
That's
story.
okay.
From 3 a.m. to 8 a.m. in the morning or something. And she comes back to her bunk bed. You've seen probably pictures, three beds stacked on top of each other. And she shares the top bed with a good friend from, Jewish woman from Amsterdam. And my mother drags herself into snow in the mud into the barracks. There was no heat. It was midwinter. It was a bad winter too. And her friend says, Lean. My mother's name was always called Lean, L-I-E-N. Lean. There's an SS man sitting in barracks number whatever it was, and he's checking on people with foreign papers. My mother says, so? She says, you told them you're an American citizen. She said, you, Joe, I know. You know I'm not an American citizen. I just made it up. She said, but you told them. I said, well, what do you got to lose? Go there. And so she talked to my mother into dragging herself some more to this barracks, and there was an SS man sitting. He said, what do you want? She said, I hear you're checking on people with foreign nationalities and papers. He said, why are you so late? She says, I didn't know about it. Nobody told me. He said, what's your name? Angelina Elizabeth Van Leer. He says, yes, he said, you're on the list. He said, get yourself ready. And 2 days from now, you will go out of here and you'll be exchanged for a German citizen. Get rid of you. And of course, she didn't believe a word of it. She just went back to work later on, and, you know. But 2 days later, she was told to pack up her belongings, which was a little bundle. There was hardly anything left. And to go on the train, Bergen-Belsen didn't have a spur going into the camp. You had to walk 2 miles out to the railway station. As she walked there was a train, big train, passenger train, standing with a big red cross on it. As she walked in, there was an SS man sitting there. She said, could I have some water to drink? I'm thirsty. He said, sit down, you're going to get coffee soon. Of course, nobody had seen coffee for years. But when as she tells all this later on, when a nurse with a starched white uniform came with a little tray with real coffee, real sugar, real milk, cream, she thought something might really happen.
And this is when? This is the early
The
19.
date is Jan. Do you want a date?
No, the
Oh.
J. I'm trying to fix it.
Sorry.
This is when? When is this? This is January of 1945.
January 21, 1945. 300 prisoners from Bergen-Belsen go on that train.
And they were repatriated to, and they actually were repatriated to, were exchanged for German citizens,
It's
or?
a very complicated story. Some people were dropped off in other concentration camps. Some new people came on who had foreign papers. I heard this all from survivors that it's 300 people from Bergen-Belsen got on the train. Several died on the way because the SS had chosen the sickest and the for you know. Some have died. Some were buried on the way. Not all 300 went to freedom.
But your mother did.
Yes, she did. They got on the train and the train started to move, and they were told all the shades were down. They were told by the SS at the penalty of death not to look at what was outside. My mother, being my mother, peeked anyway. and saw that every city they went through was totally bombed out, which made her so happy to see that it's retribution for what they'd been doing to us. That train went to a Swiss town called St. Gallen, and there, as their train steamed in on one side of the platform, another train came in from the other side with German citizens who were being exchanged. Ironically, these were German citizens from Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Had been interned by the British. Anyway, they were free, and there's a little bit more of a story, a fabulous story about my mother, but I can't go into detail. But they went on to Marseille, which was free by that time, and she was given a choice. She could go to her sister in Massachusetts, or she could go to Palestine, or she could go to a United Nations rehabilitation camp. And she had already decided she would go to her sister. She was on the SS Kungsholm, I think it's called, a Swedish ship that had been changed into a hospital ship that was full of wounded American soldiers being repatriated to the United States. And at the last minute, she ran off the gangplank into the arms of some officer standing there. He said, "Where are you going?" She said, "I don't want to go to the States." He said, "Well, where do you want to go?" She said, "I want to go to Holland." He said, "You can't go to Holland. Holland is still occupied by the Germans." She said, "What I can offer you is go to a United Nations rehabilitation camp someplace." And so she said, all right, I will do that then. She thought if she would go to a rehabilitation camp, she would be maybe closer to Europe, where her husband and their three sons might survive, although she was very pessimistic. She didn't think we would survive, having seen what was going on. But they put her on a ship in Marseille that crossed directly across the Mediterranean to Algeria. And she wound up in North Africa, in Algiers, in a United Nations rehabilitation camp called Jeanne d'Arc. It was located in Philippeville, Algiers. And that's where she stayed until the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. Where were you during all this period?
Well,
you're on your farm.
Back to May 9, 1944, when my mother is arrested. And someone comes to tell me, again, one of these mysteries, I don't know who came. Someone came to tell me on the farm, "Your mother has been caught." I am working on photo albums, photo scrap albums of the history of my family. When I come to that chapter when my mother is arrested, something like avalanche or something, and I immediately decided I must try to find my father and my two little brothers, because my mother was the one who kept everything together and alive, and now my father is alone with, and my brothers, and there no contact. And so I somehow or another, I do not know how, but I found out that they are my father and my two little brothers are together in a little summer cottage somewhere deep in the center of the end of a dirt road. And I find out that my mother, just before she gets caught, has rented this little summer cottage so she could be together with her husband and her two little boys for a couple of days. It's like gold, right? And she gets caught. And my father is with those two little boys sitting in that cottage waiting for her, and she never comes back, of course. And so I find, and I immediately decided, I said, "Pop, I'm going to quit the farm. I'm not going to go back. I said, I'm going to join you, because the winter is going to come on and there was nothing to eat in home. People were starving to death in the cities. And I, having worked on farms, had a little bit of idea how to get some food and maybe preserve it throughout the winter. You know, there were ways. And so I joined my father and my two little brothers. And the four of us tried to survive through that last winter of the war.
Which, as you said, was a tough winter, which was a very cold winter.
It was a very cold winter. We went begging from farm to farm, knocking on doors. Would you have a slice of bread? Would you have an egg? Would you have a glass of milk, please? Anything. We begged, we borrowed, we stole, we lied, anything. My two little brothers helped with everything. We had, all four of us had tasks to stay alive during that period. Lots of things happened that I can't go into the details at this point, it'll take you long. There's a painting here on the wall. No, upstairs, somewhere on the wall. We did make it through the winter. In the end, we had nothing but frozen turnips to eat. And every night we said a little prayer. I made up a little prayer for my mother, who we didn't know where she was. All we knew that she had been arrested and she was no longer in Holland. But we didn't know where she had gone. We didn't know about Bergen-Belsen. Never heard of Bergen-Belsen in the first place. We never heard of the concentration camp. People went on trains and disappeared. We said a prayer every night for my mother. And in the spring, April, the Canadian Army crossed the Rhine River, where they had been blocked through that whole last terrible winter, came to Arnhem in our direction. We weren't too far from Arnhem, by the way, towards us. And we joined with our landlord, the owner of that little cottage who lived right next door in a beautiful home. And we had a hole in the ground where we all went in to hide. And for 3 days and three nights, we were bombarded by heavy artillery fire from the Canadian Army. And I prayed, said, please, dear God, let us survive this. We have been through so much. And as the ground shook with these grenades exploding, you know, if one would have hit us, we would be gone. But after the 3 nights, 3 days and three nights, early in the morning, it got eerily still. The firing stopped, the explosion stopped. We crawled out. I remember I couldn't stand. I crawled out. We had been so shaken. We crawled out and I thought this, I could stand up, and I went right to my knees, such, you know, shaking like crazy. And so we looked around where the Germans were. Didn't see any Germans. And our neighbors, the Dutch farmers who lived there, we didn't see any farmer, nobody was around. But there was a very strange sound coming through, somewhere through the fields where there was no highway, no road, nothing. So we went to look, and I always describe it as the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. Through Holland's spring fields came an endless column of green army equipment with white stars on them. And we surmised that these must be our liberators. And so we ran to greet them, and we stood there for hours. First the tanks came by that threw dust all over us, and after that came personnel carriers with Canadian soldiers waving to
so
us. There, and after
that so was Canadian forces Canadians, that liberated
Canadians,
you?
Yeah, there's Canadian flags, and first Canadian Army, or 8th British Army, whatever it was. And after that came bridges and the kitchens with soldiers cooking as they went along, and after that all kinds of stuff. And then finally, after hours, came dozens of these little cars, these cute little cars, you know, with soldiers all covered with dust from the battles. And we waved, and they waved back, and we said, thank you, 1,000 times, you know. And I realized they wouldn't know, they didn't just liberate us. And it starts to blow. And they didn't just liberate us, they saved our lives, you know. Later on I asked them, these little cars, what kind of little cars are these? And he said, these are jeeps. Jeeps. The first American word again, jeeps. What a strange word.
When was this? Was April though? When was this that you're liberated?
This is now, I'm not exactly sure, but it must have been very close to, it may have been the 1st of May, may have been the last day of April 1945.
That close to VE Day?
Oh, yes. War ended very soon after. The new war in Europe ended very soon afterwards. But as it was, we were still in a battle zone at that time, and some very funny things happened. But I gotta tell one of them, I guess. My father, we had nothing really more to eat, but in the village, there was how do they call that? A kitchen where everyone can come to.
A soup kitchen.
A soup kitchen. There was a soup kitchen in the village of Forthausen, by the way. It's the town where we were hiding. In Forthausen. And then my father said, well, you know, I'm going to see if the soup kitchen is open. And we went, thousands of Canadian soldiers had settled down around us in tents. There was a whole encampment. And Pop went on our rally bicycle down the dirt road towards the town. And he said, with the pail on the handlebar, to get some soup for us. And he got to almost to the center of the village when all of a sudden, out of a hole in the ground, a German soldier popped out and said, "An der Straße, you know, raus!" And my father realized all of a sudden he was in German territory. You know, he turned his bike around, bicycled back. Came by, you know, there was a whole bunch of Canadian tanks parked there. And he said, "Hi," they waved to him, and he said, "Oh, hello." He was gone twice through the front line with his soup pail. Anyways, that's just the kind of stuff. But very soon after that, it was over, and we decided we must go back to Delft.
So really, for you, it was almost 5 years to the day from the invasion of, Holland.
Yeah.
Almost 5 years to
the
day.
Almost to the day. Yeah.
Where did you? Tell me about when you found your mother again, because she survived Bergen-Belsen, obviously.
What happened was that we hitchhiked back to Delft. My father, two brothers, and I. And we arrived in Delft, and we had no home, we had nothing, of course. But the Dutch resistance people in Delft, they recognized us. "Oh, Mr. Lessing, thank God, Joe, we didn't think you made it. And what do you need?" He said, "Well, we'd like to be back in our home." So one of the head of the resistance went with them to the home where my mother had pulled the door shut behind us. And there was two families in there. One was a lawyer. He said, "I'm not getting out of here. You know, I don't have another place to go." So we couldn't go back. So they took my father to an townhouse type apartment, three floors, but you know, connected. That where Dutch Nazis had lived. And they said, "You can have this. What else do you need?" My father said, "Well, a music teacher could use a piano." "Oh, we got pianos." All taken from the Nazis, you know. Gave my father a piano. We got some pieces of cloth to hang over the windows. There were no curtains. Stuff like that. And so a couple of, some beds and basic stuff, you know. A chest of drawers. And we got some forks and knives. And we started living again. My little brothers went to school. Even I went back to trade school to finish. And my cousin Hans showed up from The Hague and said, "Hey, Ed," he said, "you know, in The Hague, there are groups of young people like you who have been in hiding, and they dance and they sing, and they all want to go to the Middle East someplace, I don't know, I think it's called Palestine or something," he said, "and there are a lot of nice girls there." I said, "Oh, then I'm gonna go." I was 19 years old, I'd never been kissed in my life. And I went there, and I danced and I sang, and I was gonna go leave this goddamn Holland, where we, you know, leave this damn Europe, where by that time we begin to find out millions had been slaughtered of us Jews. And I met a nice girl there, and I'm still married to her 63 years later. And she had been in hiding in Delft, as I told you. And one of these evenings, we had this wonderful, and then the Jewish Brigade settled in Holland. These were volunteers, Jewish volunteers from Palestine, who had fought in Italy. And for the Jewish brigade, we young people were gold, as we had been despised by the Germans, been treated upon like garbage, and treated like dirt to be killed. They helped us, they gave us everything we asked for, parties, and they brought us, they gave us weekends in the country. To see these soldiers with the Star of David on their uniform, tanned with weapons, it was like almost unbelievable for us. So one night I came back from one of the meetings, I found out these are called Zionists. Mm-hmm. Zionist organization, and I was a member of the Zionist organization, and I got on the train from The Hague.